Bluebeard's Daughter by Sarah the Scene. One. You arrive at the hotel in the early hours of morning, the lobby glittering softly, empty other than for a party straggler. Big hair and heels in her hand, barefoot on the marble floors. It is the flossy paleness of her skin, the cut of her dress, that reminds you that you are not in Pakistan anymore. Her skirt drags behind her, and everything in the lobby feels placed there to be a backdrop. The fireplace, the indoor palms, the silver sculpture that glints off the sequined dress. She smiles at you as she floats towards the lift doors, and in embarrassment you look down at your phone. You text the man to let him know you have arrived safely. This is partly to assure him. He did ask that you let him know, and partly because texting him reminds you that he exists, which imbues you with confidence that you do not otherwise have. He is the secret in your back pocket that makes the world glow. At check-in, they ask for your bank card, even though you are not paying for the hotel, and you hand it over reluctantly, wondering if there is enough on it to cover you if your father forgets. His secretary is the one who booked Mandarin Oriental, one of the most expensive hotels in London you could think of. The price of your attendance at this wedding is luxury. You have never travelled alone before, never been on a plane solo, never checked into a hotel by yourself. You don't know how these things work. When they ask to scan your passport, you are suspicious, but hand it over, worried that articulating dissent will give the game up. Catch a glimpse of your tired face in the mirror behind the lobby desk and remind yourself that you are playing a part. A worldly, glamorous woman, used to international travel. One who spends weekends in Dubai and Bangkok, wears perfume every day. A woman who knows the taste of oysters and champagne and has been to a beach that isn't 40 minutes away from her house. In reality, this is the first time you have left home in 10 years. You'd never have chosen London for yourself. When you dream of Rome. Of giant bowls of pasta, of espresso and wine, exploring the city, feeling untethered, properly lost. You long to be somewhere that is empty of people you know. London is not a gift in the same way. You were born here, but you don't think about that anymore. Business or pleasure? Asks the woman checking you in. She has glossy, film star hair, which moves across her shoulders as she looks at you. I'm here for my father's wedding. There is a moment where her mouth stretches out, as if she is waiting for you to finish a joke, lips poised on a laugh. And when it doesn't come, she smooths her face and hands you a room key. It is early, so you drop your bags and go down to breakfast with a book. Never eaten on your own before either. And it bothers you less than you thought it would. Usually, it is a red-hot thing, your loneliness, pulsating around you like a glowing signal for pity. In the corners of parties, the break room at work, you are acutely aware of its stain on you. Here, in this anonymous room, people mill about their mornings, piling plates without noticing you. Fold the book by your plate, and watch as a Frenchman in his 50s is scolded by his wife for the number of pastries on his plate. You find yourself smiling at them without realising. The pancakes make you sleepy in a way that even 2 cups of warm coffee cannot counter. When you get up to the room, you fall asleep. It is only meant to be a nap. London may not be the city of your dreams, but you have plans to walk its streets. Instead, you open your eyes to nighttime. You pull back the curtains on the glittering city and the pit of your stomach drops with uncontrollable disappointment. You cannot think how this has happened. You have slept all your time away. There were plans to walk to the Victoria and Albert Museum, to eat fish and chips, to buy lipstick for Dadi and shortbread biscuits for Dada. You have slept almost 11 hours, as long as it took you to get here. For the last 10 years, all your days have been exactly the same. You teach at the Convent of Jesus and Mary, where your mother went to school. English in the afternoons, language in the mornings. At home, you mark papers while your grandparents watch television and argue over the remote control. He likes to watch the news, and she likes to watch drama serials, the kind in which a husband is always bringing home a second wife, or a young woman is feuding with her mother-in-law. Dadi will invoke your support for her choices, and you simply shake your head, decline to get involved. When the arguments get heated, as they do roughly once a week, you leave the room to make tea. Privately, the dramas bother you. Their focus on the domestic is cloying, overwhelming. Sometimes you wonder if you and your grandmother are only watching them for some way to decode your father's behaviour, discover the secret to his patterns. The dramas offer up no psychological insight, only platitudes on how to keep a husband. You have no husband to keep. And when the conversation in the room comes around to this fact, you go to bed and dream. It is the only place in the world that is yours. And now, halfway around the world, on the one day you have freedom, you have let the dream get away. Time has slid out from under your sleeping body and disappeared into the night. 2. A braver woman would have gone for a walk, but you do not even have a proper coat. So instead, you do the second bravest thing you can think of. You pull out the blue one-piece swimsuit from the suitcase and step into it, letting it sucker up your flesh, swaddling your too naked body into a robe and heading to the pool. At home, you swim sometimes in the pool of the hospital leisure centre where your cousin works. You use her pass and wear trunks over your costume for modesty. Slipping into the water without them feels sleek and silky, eel-like. After a few lengths, you lean back against the lip of the pool. The lights drift up against your closed eyes, and when you open them, you are not alone. Hello. The intruder is tall, long-limbed. Her body enters the water like a knife. You feel your mouth open and close as she swims up to you. Sorry if I startled you, she says. Her hair is one long mermaid braid over the shoulder. She shifts it to her back with a wet thwack. I love swimming at night. It's okay, you manage to respond. It's not my pool. I'm Yaz, she tells you. Her hand, as it touches yours, is warm as butter. You cannot tell from her voice where she grew up. There is an American twang shaping the vowels, but your name in her mouth is perfectly formed. What brings you to London, she asks. This is later, after you've swum lengths together in complete silence. And somehow, exiting the showers, she has invited you for a coffee. You sit in armchairs, looking out at empty streets. She is in leggings, a t-shirt for a band that was popular before either of you were born. A little younger than you are, maybe, or just better preserved. You are still in your robe, glad of its folds to hide your marshmallow body from the hard lines of hers. She leans over to pour the milk from little tubs, as taut as a bow and arrow. My father's getting married, you say, leaving out the number because you don't want to scare her off. Her eyebrows arch gently. Oh, funny. I'm here for a wedding too. That's nice for him anyway. Do you get along with your new mama? We've not met yet. So you're not close? No, not really, you respond. The last time I saw him was maybe 5 years ago? Yaz looks at you as if you have known each other in a previous life. There is an understanding in her eyes that feels heavy on you. Why are you really here then? You don't seem to want to be. No one has asked you this before. Even the people who know you well have never thought to separate in this way. Your duty from your desires. I don't know, you say. You are thinking of the man, the phone buzzing in your bed. Maybe I just needed to get away. She tips her head to one side. You get the feeling that she understands the strings that have drawn you here, the familial obligations that rule your life. She must have been familiar with them too, but you can tell they no longer control her. From the way she stands out at the window, as if the skyline belongs to her, it is clear that she is not a puppet. There is a softness to how she looks at you, as if she's handling a child. How would you like some perspective? On what? She shrugs. Oh, I don't know. Your situation. Anything. You hesitate. Talking about your problems never seems to bring you relief. There is always the sense that what you are saying is not fully private, that it will loop through the people you are talking about like wildfire and come back to burn you. It was never easy to talk about your father, but since things began with the man, speaking with sincerity to anyone at all is complicated. It's okay, she says. You don't have to tell me anything. Let's ask the cards. She unveils a stack of tarot cards. I do this all the time for my friends, she tells you. And you realise she's one of those hippie types that Dolly rolls her eyes at. Diaspora kids who find spiritualism outside of religion. Yoga twice a week and flaunt belly button rings. Her hands glow in the dark as she cuts them with the precision of a blackjack dealer. You pick three. The images do not make sense to you. Yaz pours over them intently. She has put her glasses on, big gold frames that make her look smart, like a librarian or an English teacher. You are running from something, she tells you. Her finger is on the picture of a woman veiled in swords, like a rabbit from a trap. And, you ask? You think of the man, how your number is saved in his phone under a fake name, a small detail that has always bothered you. While his messages glow in your hand, he turns yours face down, like the cards. Yaz puts down her cards and cradles your hands in her own. Is it a man? She asks. You shake your head too quickly. Keep running, she says, very seriously, her voice drawn down like a curtained afternoon. 3. Your father wants to have coffee. He doesn't even ask because he knows you would say no. Instead, he sends a message saying he's going to come by the hotel at noon. He only knows where you are staying because he paid for the room. And you only came to London because he said he would pay. This is what your relationship is like, a transactional loop. You knew there was a catch, that the arrangement comes with strings attached. He's always 2 steps ahead of you. It is too late to argue, so you dress slowly. Your London clothes are old and most don't fit. The top button of your jeans won't clasp around your soft middle. Dolly had suggested this might be the case, and you'd sneeringly ignored her suggestions to try them on before leaving. Her offers take you shopping for new things. You pull a jumper down over your jeans and hope he won't notice. He has never paid much attention to your physical appearance before. He might raise eyebrows at your unbrushed hair or hairy arms, but he would never acknowledge it. He will want to talk about the grandparents, He will ask about your job, as if he thinks this is what a father is supposed to do. You are the only person who calls him by his first name. Not even his wives have done that. He flinches when you use it, making you wonder who has held it in their mouth before. Your mother, perhaps, or Dada before he moved away. Rizvan, you say, when you open the door and follow him into the corridor. The old jacket is tight around the shoulders now. A pinch that you try to pretend is good for your posture. At the cafe, you order a cinnamon bun, deconstruct it with a fork and knife. He orders kombucha, from which you try to ascertain what this says about his new wife. With the second one, he'd been reborn as a socialite, wearing loose shirts and gold watches everywhere, sunglasses indoors and going to 3 parties a week. A different man to the one who'd been married to your mother, who spent most of his time in the study, the door shut, complaining when your music was too loud. You guess. She probably does yoga. He is probably trying to be vegan, but will occasionally eat chicken biryani on his own at Drummond Street after work, swilling mouthwash to dispel the evidence before he gets home. The two of you don't have much to say to each other. Talk about the weather, your jobs, like old acquaintances who only speak at parties. The best thing about your father's company is that he is the only person who never asks if you intend to get married. Admitting that at the age of 36, you are an adult, a viable romantic candidate, would be too embarrassing for him. Admitting that you are still single at this age, even more so. Your 7th birthday party, the only one he ever attended, he'd sat you down and said, "Darling, you're so pretty. Boys are going to like you, but they might like you even more if you're not afraid to play it cool." You were crying because the boy you liked had given Lisa the sweets he'd knocked out of the piñata with the gallantry of a knight giving a lady the spoils of war. It would apparently have been more sophisticated to ignore it. But the advice only made you cry harder. If you were going to be hurt and you weren't allowed to show it, what was the point in trying? The man texts while your father pays, and you try to resist the temptation to look immediately. You could cultivate a life away from him in London, thinking about which might drive him crazy. The phone is sitting face down on the table. You count to 10 before you flip it over. He wants to call you. You make excuses to leave, to find a park bench while you wait. 45 minutes later, you are still waiting, holding your legs together to keep from wetting yourself through your clothes. "I'm sorry," he says. You concentrate, shivering, on his voice and not your body. "He's tired," he says. "He hasn't been sleeping." "I think it's because you are so far away," he says, even though you never see each other in Karachi. The words warm and still you. He says the exhaustion is keeping him from his work, that he is making mistakes at the desk, and you feel powerful to be part of this destruction. This is what love must be, wanting to hurt someone so you can heal them later. Like how, when he doesn't pick up the phone for 2 or 3 or even 6 days, your conversations after are softer than butter. He will wheedle you with compliments that brush away the anxiety, the itch of a hand reaching for an empty phone. 4. On the day of the wedding, you slick eyeliner onto your lids inexpertly and realise you are trying to look like Yaz. Most of the time in the mirror, you have no idea what you're doing. The colours go onto your skin in experimental splotches. Today, you have a mission, and it is to wear Yaz's face. The man calls halfway through. You're going to be late if you pick it up. Spray perfume while you speak as if he can smell you. He tells you about his day. You search for the gold bangles Siddharthi gave you to wear. He was supposed to call an hour ago. The apology is vague, so you know it is his wife who has been keeping him. He has always been easy to read for you. You have never slept in the same bed, or even touched in many years, but you know him better than anybody else. This is not a boast against his wife, who has many things over you. She is more beautiful, thinner, her eyeliner more perfect, experienced in things you cannot imagine. How to throw a dinner party, how to placate a mother-in-law, how to be a wife. You have nothing over her, other than the fact that you know him and she does not. The two of you have been in each other's lives since you were children, though there was nothing between you then, nothing till after he got married. Whatever this is, and you cannot, even in your mind, bring yourself to call it an affair, began 2 years after his wedding. You ran into each other at a French class. He only attended the first one and never came back. This didn't surprise you. You remember him, the way he cut corners, his inherent laziness. Adult education was never going to be on the cards for him. But after that lesson, he offered to drive you home. The building cleared out. The late afternoon sun beating down on your face. You shielded your eyes with your hand and did not look straight at him. Darla was supposed to send his driver to pick you up, but he was late. "It's okay," he said. "I don't mind waiting." "Well, I do, and I can't leave you waiting here in the street. They have to close the building soon." The car smelled too much of him, like the volume of his scent turned up. It was warm from sitting in the sun, the seats sizzling against you, the intimacy of the front seat, wedding ring on his left hand. He'd been listening to Fleetwood Mac before class, and it picked up again as he turned on the ignition. "Are you laughing at me?" he asked. You smiled. It was easy to make fun of him, to play the part of a woman who was comfortable riding in cars with men she didn't know very well, who could perhaps even flirt a little. He didn't take the bait. His face in the mirror was serious. "What do you want to listen to?" he asked. You let him put on a song you loved, and you didn't speak the rest of the way, stuttering slowly through thick traffic in almost complete silence. You were too nervous to turn and look at him, so all you saw was the glimpse of his profile in the sun, the warm curve of his nose and jaw. You could never explain this to another person, which is why no one knows about the man. But something passed between you that day, stuck on Chara Faisal, in the middle of the afternoon rush. The kind of melting into each other that you imagined was reserved for something else, for Bollywood films where people rubbed up against each other in front of a sunset, for the Mills and Boons your mother hid behind her mattress. You learned nothing from those movies or books, except that what they described was golden, impossible, belonging to a more beautiful race. Even at school, you could not feign the possibility that it might happen to you. Not like other girls, who stuck photos of Shahid Afridi and Brendan Fraser in the backs of their notebooks, swooned over them, over the boys at school who gelled up their hair, the ones who were cocky enough to pull at girls' hair or ask to hold their hand. You knew whatever it was that these children were searching for would never belong to you. And yet, here it was, in a car, boomeranging back to you from almost 20 years ago. "I'm sorry," he said, when you were getting out of the car. "What for?" "Your 7th birthday party. I said I'd share my sweets with you and then I gave them to Lisa instead." The fact that he remembered. The fact that he stole your number off the sheet passed around in class and texted you later that evening. The fact that he reminded you that you used to let him cheat off you in maths class, and if he came back to French, would you let him do that now? Your whole body tightens like a fist, your insides lifting towards him, towards the possibility of a new life. Since then, you've spoken almost every day, usually in the middle of the night, usually when nobody else is awake. "I'm desperate," he says. And you do not tell him that he could leave her, that there is still a possible world in which you can be together, but it won't last forever. You could tell him that you won't wait forever, but it would be a lie. You stand by the window looking down into the park. It is a sunny day. Of course it is sunny on your father's wedding day, as if the sun would dare to be anywhere else. People are walking their dogs and their children. Across the way, another bride and her groom are being photographed, canoodling in a gazebo. The man has two pictures on his desk, one of his wedding day and the other of his parents. The pictures mirror each other. Traditional portraits of women clad in red, their foreheads bracketed in gold. Their hands touch the groom's lapels as if smoothing them down. This is not the phone call you had been hoping for. You'd been hoping he would be sweet, for him to ask for pictures of you all dressed up. He always says he would love to see you in a sari, love to see you be more feminine. Not that he doesn't like you how you are. Short hair, stiff shirts, your walk, which is the most confident he's ever seen. But different, softer. You would turn the camera on and let him watch where you pouted your mouth for lipstick. He'd ask how you felt about the afternoon, would wish he could go with you. Instead, he arrives in the day like a stormy cloud. He offers his unhappiness to you, and you swallow it down like medicine. "It's okay," you tell him. "I'm here to listen." 5. You miss the ceremony, which doesn't bother you as it might have done in the past. Not the stomach-curling fear that might have caught you out before. The reception is easier, busier, no one watching as you enter. People don't pay attention to you, just the food and the drinks. 20 minutes before anyone even acknowledges you. You wonder how many of these people even know you exist. Uncle Raj, your father's oldest friend, pulls you aside. He kisses you on both cheeks. The bristles on his handlebar mustache are invasive. He smells like your father, the same Brill Cream slick back, Johnny Walker and Pan on his breath. "I'm the only one," he tells you in a stage whisper, "who has been to all 3 of the weddings." You were at the first one, in your mother's belly, but you don't ever talk about that. The bride scolds you for your lateness. Of course, she's beautiful, the common denominator in your father's choices. Her hair is laid in the glossy curls of a woman very familiar with her hairdresser. She's only 4 or 5 years older than you, but her voice is sharp, a rap across the knuckles. When she sees that your father won't engage with it, she turns to softness. "I just mean it would have been so lovely to have you there." You congratulate her. The cracking of the light over her hair makes the veil look like a crown. "I'm so happy," she says, taking your hands in hers. "Your father is the man I've always dreamed of." It is true. She is smiling with all her teeth. Everyone in the room looks happy. It looks like a wedding. People are dancing, eating cake, taking pictures. No one else has absorbed the horror of this day as you have. To them, your father is a man they can be happy for. You look at him and you want to smear the smile off his face. "Do you know," you find yourself saying, "that he left my mother when she was ill?" You do know that, don't you? Someone must have told you. You are speaking to the bride, but it is his face that you watch. It doesn't go hard with anger, but full of unearned softness. He reaches for your wrist, but you wrench it away, He is a trap, you say to the bride. Do you understand that? You have to get away from him. I understand you're upset, she begins. But you cannot stand to be in front of them. There is cake somewhere in this room, and eating it might make you feel like being here has a purpose. As you walk away from them, you don't look back. Rizvan does not follow you. He never did. 6. Yaz is a miracle. A mirage. In line for the bathroom, you see her. At first, it feels like perhaps you're so obsessed with her that your eyes have conjured her face onto another woman's. But no, it is her, washing her hands in the sink, her tattooed arms that reach up to push back glossy hair. She spots the tracks of tears in your foundation and immediately pulls you aside. Are you all right? She asks. When you say no, she offers you a cigarette. You smoke on the terrace. It has been a long time since you've had one. Dadi said if she caught you with one in your mouth again, she would kick you out of the house. They used to taste of freedom, but you can't feel that anymore. So, she says, you've done what you came here to do. What is that? You've escaped from your trap. What are you going to do now? Yaz looks at you intently. Her eyes are the kind of brown that seem to go on forever. The colour of muddy sunsets, of chocolate mousse. She doesn't look as wise as she did back in the swimming pool. Not a terrifying goddess, but a woman. I go home, I guess. You think of your grandparents' house, the circular day. You are 36. These days could last for a long time yet. They could last for what feels like forever. The tiredness you experience when you have this thought washes through your lungs so fast, it seems impossible to breathe. You don't have to do that, she says. You could do anything else. You could go anywhere. You don't have to be good all the time. You don't have to be good at all. Goodness is not real. Or at least yours is only an illusion. People mistake your passivity for kindness. It makes you sick how long this has been true. Where are you off to? Tonight? I'm going to go meet some friends in town. You're not sure if you are giddy from the exhaustion of the day, or if she really is blowing smoke rings. Do you want to come? She asks. And the offer is so tempting, you think you must have misheard. The phone buzzes next to you. It's the man with another problem. It must be his wife. Dinner at her parents' house. A nightmare of his. They don't get along. You could answer it and calm him down on the way to the bar. You could tell Yaz and her friends about it over drinks. They don't understand him, you might say. He's an intellectual and they just aren't. She stands up. The full flick of her body is as intimidating as the first time you saw her, sinking into the pool like a dream. Are you coming? Yaz reaches out her hand. There is no reason to go back inside, to say goodbye to your father and his bride. Whatever goodwill was left between you is gone now. You've seen to that. Pick up your jacket, your purse, the lipstick you brought to impress, leave the room key and the phone on the table. As you walk to the gate, it is still buzzing, its body threatening to teeter to the floor.